Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, November 20th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan.
So Donald Trump picks Dr. Oz to oversee Medicare, Medicaid, and affordable care. Then we also heard about the other big pick last night. Well, there were two. The three big picks were the Dr. Oz pick. Then there was also the Linda McMahon pick, and chosen to be the education secretary, which is, I think, important. And then we also had Treasury, right?
Commerce.
I'm sorry. Commerce, which was...
I was just listening to it, and the name is... Was it Harold?
I have it right in front of me here somewhere. I'll find it in just a matter of seconds. But so those are the three biggies from yesterday. And but before we go into those individually, which I do think they're all worthy of just spending a few moments on talking about individually, I would just like to look at this sort of overarching article in the Washington Post, which the headline is "Trump ignores transition rules. An ally says it's a hostile takeover." Donald Trump's transition team has begun what a close ally calls a hostile takeover of the federal government, ignoring the rules of the handover of power in the process. 1,000 miles from the austere buildings where Washington runs, Donald Trump's transition team in his Mar-a-Lago resort has begun what a close ally calls a hostile takeover of the federal government. Since his victory, Trump has ignored many of the rules and practices intended to guide a seamless transfer of power and handover of the oversight of 2.2 million federal employees. Instead, the president-elect, who has pledged to fire thousands of civil servants and slash billions of dollars in spending, has so far almost fully cut out the government agencies his predecessors have relied on to take charge of the federal government. Trump has yet to collaborate with the GSA, General Services Administration, which is tasked with the complex work of handing over control of hundreds of agencies, because he has not turned in required pledges to follow ethics rules. His transition teams have yet to set foot inside a single federal building. In calls with foreign heads of state, Trump has cut out the State Department, its secure lines, and its official interpreters. As his team considers hundreds of potential appointees for key jobs, he's so far declined to let the Federal Bureau of Investigation check for potential red flags and security threats to guard against espionage, instead relying on private campaign lawyers for some appointees and doing no vetting at all for others. Trump's transition team is considering moving on his first day in office to give those appointees blanket security clearances, according to people familiar with the discussions who spoke on the condition of anonymity. At the root of this unprecedented approach, say those close to Trump's transition, is an abiding distrust and a resentment of federal agencies that the president-elect blames for blocking his agenda in his first term, leaking his plans to the press and later sharing his documents with investigators and bringing criminal charges against him. So that was four paragraphs, and it seemed like there's enough to give you a little concern. First of all, welcome to Heather Mulligan. Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I would say the traffic was absurd.
Yes, it is absolutely. And actually has been. We've been having just it's been an issue just getting in here over the last couple, I don't know, since the election. It's very weird. All right. So here we go on this particular story of what can be considered a hostile takeover. Malia, what do you make of it?
Well, there are, I want to just sort of go over some of the similarities I see with the last Trump transition and some of the differences. So the last transition, he also didn't collaborate with GSA or go through any of this vetting or anything like that. But that's because, and here's the difference, they were so far behind. He didn't have any nominees. He wasn't announcing things. I mean, it was just like, oh, we won the election. And then I don't think they really got going until like very close to inauguration and even afterwards. And so the fact that they have all these nominees now is the real difference. But the lack of you know, collaboration with the government and going by transition rules and following ethics guidelines, I don't think that's any different from what we saw before. And so I think what this points to is that this the Trump administration, his transition team is much more prepared this time around. They have a long-term agenda. They know exactly what they want to accomplish. They've got their team together, and they're just going to put it in place no matter what, basically. And the qualifications, as far as they're concerned, for these roles have nothing to do with the kind of vetting that the FBI might undertake or that an ethics commission might undertake. That's not what the Trump transition team and Trump himself count as valuable qualifications. It's loyalty to the agenda and loyalty to him personally.
So, Bob Griffin, color me silly, but it isn't one of the reasons that we had always had these for want of a better term, checks and balances, at least looking at things like vetting and clearances and so forth, that this would ultimately secure us as a nation?
Yeah, it's you know, absurdity is the rule of the day. And Malia, your comments, let me sort of try to pull some of those strings over here, too. It's almost like they have a roadmap in something called Project 2025. And again, if you go back and you read that document, there are many of these steps that are following. The fact that they haven't reached out to GSA and haven't started to perform the normal steps of a peaceful transition of power means that the legal guardrails are not in place, which means that the legal vetting aren't in place. The legal requirements of people in his administration to begin the process of disclosure of what conflicts of interest they have are not being done. This is all purposeful, Joe. This is all purposeful. But what people need to understand is that in the past, in order to go in and assume the reins of power, the people had the right to be able to understand where the conflicts of interests are in the people who are serving in the administration. That's not in place, which I think is a absolutely horrible precedent. This issue of blanket security clearances is going to bite the country on the ass. It's going to create, I think, enormous issues for us. Am I surprised? No. No, I'm not. You know, a hostile takeover, at some point in time, we need to understand that if the country survives this, there's going to be so much damage that is being done to the apparatus of government and to institutions that I see decades of cleanup. Bad precedent, Joe. Really bad precedent. And when you start to layer on the fact that we still don't understand the blank check immunity that the Supreme Court has given to the presidency and the power of pardons, I would imagine that we're looking at years of litigation. This is almost like the full Security Act for lawyers in the future.
Heather.
So I'm not at all surprised. I think that you know, the incoming president has a essential distrust of sort of the bureaucracy and the people, the lifers in the administration. And I think Malia is right that he highly values loyalty. And there is this sense of urgency. I agree 100% that I mean, they were kind of caught by surprise. They were the dog that caught the car the first time. And I don't mean that in any way, like, disrespectfully, but I think that they were caught off guard last time, and so they learned from that. So there's this whole, you know, people that I think he's had in mind from the beginning, and he wants to get them in place quickly. And I think he does correctly have a perception that, you know, moving at the speed of government is not something that is going to be helpful in that. A lot of times these things take a great deal of time. And if you distrust the machinery that's in place, you could assume that they would intentionally go slow, that they would intentionally slow down getting the administration in place. And that's the last thing that he wants. So, I completely agree that there are valid reasons for these background checks and that they're necessary. But at the same time, I am also not surprised that they're going to do it their own way, because, if at all. But but I think the real question that we should all be asking ourselves is, what job is the MyPillow guy going to get? Because, you know, I've been trying to think of what is the wildest position.
He's going to carry the nuclear briefcase.
Yeah, I don't know.
Have it wrapped in a big pillow.
Yeah. I had one of those I bought as a joke for my middle son one year for Christmas, because he was imitating the MyPillow guy all the time. So I bought him one, and I'm just going to say, like, it's the worst pillow. It's not good. It's not good at all.
Boy, he seems so talented.
I know.
let me ask this to all of you, but I'll start with Bob. How much of this is what we keep on referring to when we think of the Stephen Millers and the Steve Bannons when we talk about this, but the deep state of trying to alleviate that completely? And then also basically, I mean, I know this, but almost like shadow government-like.
I mean, I think that's the boogeyman that he's created. I think that it's a raw excuse, the same way it was a raw excuse that there was voter fraud last time, and then all of a sudden this election is just perfect. You know, Heather, I understand your comment, but this idea that somehow it's government inefficiency and bureaucracy that's blocking it. And I'll toss at you the fact that it's him appointing people that are unfit for office. Okay. And so this idea that he's doing this to work around it because he's an efficient businessman is just bullpucky. In that he's putting
that is
people
not,
in.
To be clear, not what he, I said. Is,
but,
so,
but that's what I heard. So,
well, I'm sorry,
no,
is not what I said. Okay. I did not say because he's some efficient businessman. I said because he distrusts the people who are part of the bureaucracy, and I again don't mean bureaucracy in a disrespectful way, but he distrusts the people that were there. And he's trying to do it quickly. And I did not for one second say, oh, and he's being, you know, an efficient businessman. I'm saying I think that's what the motivations are. And I think that's why we're seeing this.
But that's the narrative they're trying to put out, to see that well, we're bringing efficiency to this, or we're dealing with this deep state. And that's where I think it becomes really dangerous. It also becomes a continued part of this narrative that somehow the government is at fault, and he's protecting the people from the government.
Okay, I also did not say that.
No, you did not. But I'm saying that's not your narrative. But again, if you read Project 2025, that is exactly the narrative that's in. And when you read the comments, even folks up on the Hill saying that he has this mandate, That's also part of this whole narrative.
And that's why the statement that's a hostile takeover, that's a gleeful statement. Yeah. They the transition team, his administration, considers the government they're about to take over as the enemy, right? So they're not going to abide by anything that they think they can avoid. Now, it's not within the purview of the president to just completely reshape the executive branch without any kind of oversight. It's, you know, Congress created all, you know, the departments, and the cabinet exists because Congress sets aside money for it. And so there has to be a back and forth with Congress. But I think he's got enough loyalists who have been elected into Congress that a lot of the things that he that Trump wants to achieve with the government are probably going to go through the oversight committees. But they have to go through those oversight committees. He can't just wave a wand and change the structure of the government entirely. He can bypass some of these rules. He can decline to participate in like these ethics and but he can't dismantle existing structures without some kind of imprimatur from Congress.
Anybody else?
I think that's right. I think there are still existing guardrails in place. I think he is also someone who loves to test the system.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, that's what we're seeing with, the attempted appointment of Matt Gaetz, which I think is not going to happen.
They're gleefully girding for a fight that they will enjoy.
I do. I think that this is all consistent with his personality. I mean, it's just this is what people elected and they knew that that's what they were going to get. I mean, I don't think anyone should be like terribly surprised by any of this. And that was my point. I'm not surprised.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 20th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, November 21st, Joe was joined by an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Yesterday, I was bereft, for want of a better term, of just thinking about the actions of the United States Congress yesterday, in which they remain deadlocked on releasing the Matt Gaetz report, and said that Mike Johnson and the spokesperson said for the Trump transition team, Stephen Chung, said Matt Gaetz will be the next attorney general. And so they worked really hard within the halls of Congress yesterday to make that the issue. And the other issue, so that was to allow someone who is accused of being a sex trafficker and attending drug-fueled parties with minors to be the attorney general. So that's that. And then Sarah McBride, the incoming congresswoman from the state of Delaware, the first out transgender person elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, the House in all its glory votes that regarding facilities throughout the U.S. complex, they will not be able to be used by a transgender member of the House.
Or the public.
Or the public. Now, so I have many questions about this. First of all, I don't really understand what they're worried about, because Have any of these congressmen ever been on a plane? Like, there's just one. You go up, you go to the bathroom, and you come out. Like, that's it.
What's wrong with that? Like, I don't get it. I don't get it. And I just, so there's that. But to your point, Nick, right, not just for Sarah McBride. And all single-sex facilities in the Capitol and House office buildings, such as restrooms, changing rooms, and locker rooms, are reserved for individuals of that biological sex. And this is where I don't know the law, which I'm hoping you can help me with, Nick. But is that not discriminatory? Is that not against the law?
So I don't think it's against the law under the federal law. It would be against the law in New York State, but not in the Capitol. I just want to note that this came on the day of transgender remembrance, which remembers the tens of thousands of people who have been murdered because they are transgender. And this is a targeted attack and an effort to bully a woman who hasn't even been seated and is a distraction, really, from the many, many gross and unethical things coming to light in the House and among its own House members. And it's just so many things. So McBride will have her own bathroom in her office. She'll be able to use the unisex bathrooms, which there are unisex bathrooms in the Capitol as well. So this is really a change to gender-specific bathrooms and bathrooms that are shared, multi-person bathrooms, right? But it's the message, right? It's the messaging. Lauren Boebert said she would physically fight a woman coming out of a single-use bathroom if she thinks or believes that that person is transgender. Like, how offensive and gross is that outlook, that you're going to watch somebody come out because it's not a multi-use person bathroom. It's like you're saying, it's a single-use bathroom. Somebody comes out and like, oh, I think because I have a gender bias and I hold sexist ideas in my mind, I'm going to start a physical fight with somebody who's just using the bathroom. It is like crushing to the soul, I think.
So, right. Absolutely crushing to the soul. Mike Johnson said, it is important to note that each member office has its own private restroom and unisex restrooms are available throughout the Capitol. Well, right. So then don't bring it up as an issue. Then just not make it an issue. It's the then taking it to women deserve women's only spaces that is the thing that will make your head spin.
But those women also have their own private bathrooms, right? Like, if you don't want to share a bathroom with somebody else, you can just go to your own office private bathroom, right? And I think what's also interesting is the use of the term biological women. And it's also interesting that they're not talking about transgender men at all. But biological women, it lacks any relationship to the medical science around transgender identities and transgender people, because the notion of biological women is kind of a false narrative. And it's remarkable that electeds who have no background in this medical science are deciding that somebody who's assigned a sex at birth is therefore that biological sex, which is false on its face. So there's that.
The other thing about this, and I know, you know, you could go on and on about this, and I there's just so much that I am trying to understand, but in the choices, in the picks for the cabinet, the president-elect keeps on saying people around the president-elect keep on saying that these are picks that are made because this particular, in this election, he has a mandate and we should give him the cabinet that he wants. I would just like to point out that Sarah McBride handily won her district over the Republican by at least 9 percentage points. I would even call that a mandate.
I thought that she really handled the attack well.
Beautifully.
Absolutely, I didn't come here to argue about bathrooms. It's like, yeah, show them what you did come here for.
I'm working on housing.
Yeah.
I'm working on food and food insecurity. That's right. She handled it beautifully. Absolutely beautifully. But
it's still disappointing.
The issue
she shouldn't have
to. Exactly. Yeah.
Like, she shouldn't have to do that assimilation performance in order to be able to just do her job.
Mm-hmm. But the Republicans have taken transgender issues and run with it. They thought it was very successful with them during the for them during the presidential election, and clearly they're not going to let this one go and expect to see more of this craven political grandstanding. I think, who was it, Nancy Mace, who is the leader on this one? It's just wrong, and I think it's one of the reasons everyone on both sides of the aisle tend to dislike Congress.
So what's her problem?
Yeah, what is her problem? Because and what is all their problems with? Again, I agree with you. Have they ever gone to the bathroom on an airplane? Or I have been in enough situations where I've seen people attacked, not a challenged for being in a bathroom where some person suspects that they shouldn't belong in that bathroom, and you can't help but feel great empathy for the person who's just trying to perform a basic bodily function at a public bathroom and being attacked. Rightly, it's just wrong.
I find it that to be the order of the day. And yet we keep having this conversation. It's the chicken and the egg question of why do we have to talk about this? And yet, like, okay, and I know, like, I wish we could talk about other things, but I think it's important that we do, because it's just it's so egregious in my mind. But all right, letters. We go to Susan. As a lobbyist, I wandered the halls of the House, and I dearly hope the bathrooms aren't closed to the public. Also, it's laughable to think anyone will be around to police the bathrooms. The building is mostly populated with young staffers who are busy doing their own work. Then Clayton says, full stop, homophobia, pure and simple. Mary, it isn't about bathrooms. It wasn't about water fountains. Then we go to this note, I believe, from R, who says, dear panel, don't you realize that the joke is on us? Matt Gaetz will be the next attorney general because of our new dictator in chief, and he wants him to be. We're laughing at the thought of him as attorney general, but let's not forget that we also laughed at the idea of Trump winning the election. These are not normal things anymore. Trump's win means that corruption has now reached the highest level of our government. The larger tragedy here is that we can no longer view our government as one that will always stand for what is right in the world. And then we go to Carolyn, who says, so I have a question. Where is the outcry from the evangelical Christians about the Gaetz nomination, or is sexual abuse okay with them?
It's a good question. It's all, you know, where was their outcry over Trump? I mean, he's not necessarily a moral man, even though he sells Bibles, so there's that. I mean, if you ask him to quote something from the Bible, he wouldn't be able to. I think they accepted Trump for their own. I mean, the ends justify the means for political organizations. And apparently that's the deal that they have struck with someone who, again, has been convicted of sexually abusing a woman in civil court.
Mike writes, with what we know about Matt Gaetz, it is apparent that he would be an easy target for blackmail. That alone should disqualify him from being the head of to be the attorney general. Then we go to Russ, who says the chairman of the House House Ethics Committee is Republican. No report naming Gates will be issued. All other allegations are the product of illegitimate news purveyors such as the New York Times. Trump is fond of scofflaws, and if he wants to run a criminal enterprise from the White House, there's nothing to stop him. He has two MAGA-dominated legislative bodies and a neutered Supreme Court. That from Russ.
I'd actually say it's an empowered Supreme Court.
And I would say it's a legitimate New York Times. I think discrediting the mainstream news media when you don't like the news they're producing, there are basic standards the New York Times follows in terms of vetting documents that they receive that are leaked to them. They make sure that they're correct before they print them. I have every faith that this, you know, Venn diagram or what? It's not a Venn diagram. It's a this chart that they published is accurate. Going forward, we need to rely on the news media to provide us essential information that the Congress won't release, that people are hiding. It's going to be harder and harder going forward because under the Trump administration, they're going to be taking a very hard look at leaks and comments to the press. So buckle your seatbelts, Joe.
Yes, Judy. Ray writes, the transgender issue you are discussing is another example of MAGA forces reminding us all of Trump's promise to protect all women, whether they like it or not. That was Nick's point earlier. And how sad and how threatening, says Ray. Wanda Sykes, the comedian, hit the nail on the head, writes Patricia, when she pointed out on the Jimmy Kimmel Show that Republicans have managed to make an issue out of transgender population, which is less than 1%, and have convinced people that climate change, which affects 100% of our population, is an absolute hoax. Oh, remember when things like that were funny? I think that is it for the immediate letters before me.
I think that is the point, right? The point is to distract and occupy our minds, our thoughts, our efforts around issues that, you know, deeply affect and are extremely important, but to a small portion of the public, so that we don't have the bandwidth to also tackle the, you know, universal issues that are, you know, putting our lives at risk, right? Like climate change is having a tremendous impact on the globe and also the United States. And in really acute and specific regions, we're facing some of the biggest and worst forest fires and forest fire conditions in the Northeast that I've ever experienced and can remember at all. And we just don't have the bandwidth to tackle both things at the same time in some ways. It's like you have like this bad news like bandwidth that just gets exploited by GOP, you know, circus performances, and it's really difficult to say we can tackle both things, we should tackle both things, but we're talking about the headlines instead of this
right,
you know, the forest fires, for example, or the tremendous change in average temperature in the Capital Region, which is, you know, being seen in our lifetime as just
the
extreme changes.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, November 21st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, November 22nd, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti. We are also joined by Siena College Economics majors from the Federal Reserve Challenge Course, Joelle Becker, Angela Everett, Molly McBain, and Arthur Pasquale.
We spent a good part of the week this past week talking about the nomination of Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, and then there was a series of reports and investigations, and a report that was part of the Congressional Ethics Committee looking at some very serious allegations in regards to Congressman Gaetz and sex with a minor, sex trafficking, these drug-fueled parties. And so on Wednesday, Matt Gaetz went to Capitol Hill and made his way through with J.D. Vance, who will be the Vice President of the United States. And they went through a meeting with Senate leadership, trying to drum up support for Matt Gaetz. Apparently, and there's various reporting on this, but I'm going to go with this story because it seems to be the most accurate, which is that there was apparently they found another instance, another case, another woman, and some much more damaging information that they were getting ready, I believe CNN in this case, were getting ready to release. It was a short time after that President-elect Trump called up Matt Gaetz and said, I don't think you have the votes, which is a way of saying this is over. And so Matt Gaetz said that not to bog down the process any further, he would step aside and would withdraw from to be in the running to be the Attorney General of the United States. Then, just moments later, a short time later, we got an announcement that a new AG nominee had been named. So I'm going to do this in order, but so let's talk about Matt Gaetz first, and then we'll talk about Pam Bondi, who is now the nominee for the role of Attorney General. Teresa, do you have anything you'd like to share on this?
You imagine that I might.
Yes. It may have been the text I got that said, "We live in dangerous times."
That's right. So, I mean, I think that some of this was inevitable. I mean, the sort of Matt Gaetz. It's always good to have friends, and clearly he didn't have enough of them in this case. Because I think that it's, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, well, let's say with the support, the Republicans in the Senate supported Donald Trump. And they supported him through the January 6th attack on the Capitol and all sorts of convictions, including for sexual assault and all the accusations and such. So clearly that in and of itself, Matt Gaetz's behavior in and of itself, I think, was not a disqualifier from the Trump perspective, right? But let's step back, bigger picture. The norm since post-Watergate, and maybe before, but certainly post-Watergate, has been that the Attorney General must be both independent and then competent, qualified. So clearly Matt Gaetz is not independent of Trump, and clearly his resume didn't suggest in any way, even separate from all of the accusations against him, he was in no way qualified. But I also think that we are not looking at things that are going on, like the potential for what's going on at the Office of Management and Budget, which really controls not just fiscal affairs, but regulatory affairs. And it looks like the key architect of Project 2025 is going to be named the head of the OMB. And that puts him, Russell Vogt, in a pretty powerful position. So Donald Trump, you know, I see nothing. I've never heard of Project 2025. I don't even know who they are. So far, four of his nominees are key to Project 2025. So I think that...
Office of Management
and Budget. I'm sorry, Office of Management and Budget. So I think the Gates situation, it was just a matter of time before they got to where they were going. And I know we'll get to her in a minute. But I think if you look at Pam Bondi's, who's the new nominee, her connections, clearly she was the preferred person for a number of people. I think that she was inevitably going to be it anyway. But I think sort of Matt Gaetz is, this was always going to happen, but he served his purpose.
Aaron?
Yeah, I think the Gaetz nomination, which surprised, that was the first, right? That was the first cabinet nomination.
I don't think it was the first, but it was the first that made you clasp your heart.
Okay. I think that, you know, there's something strategic in doing that, because I think, you know, it solved three purposes. And, you know, the first thing is that, like, remember, Trump's a narcissist. He wants the spotlight. So this was something that got people talking about Trump and what he's planning on doing. So it solved that objective, and, you know, it made a rating splash. This is a, you know, somebody who spent 16 years on The Apprentice. So this is, you know, just a reality TV show playing out in 21st century American politics. So it got Trump and the media, I'm sorry, it got the media focused on Trump because the nomination was so outlandish. The second thing is that given how outlandish it was, I think it really tired a lot of people out. Oh, how can it be Gaetz? This guy's got no experience. And then blah, 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 blah. And it's almost just like at some point you just get worn down. And that's part of Trump's broader strategy, is just lobbing these bombs into, you know, the media and the political landscape. And the reason he does that, I think, is the third reason. And that is so that people, particularly Senate Republicans who are going to be in charge of the confirmation, have a much easier time confirming someone else. They're like, well, at least it's not somebody who's been accused of having sex with underage women and sex trafficking.
Right. That's the president.
Right. That's the president. That's the president. So
he got reelected.
But he shifted the goalposts so far to the not even to the right. It's an outer space at this point. And anybody he nominates after that is going to appear to be a sane, qualified candidate, even if they aren't, or even if they hold very extreme positions. So I think I don't know whether Trump actually believed Gaetz would get confirmed. I doubt he did, because he's not that oblivious. And I think he used that to a very strategic effect to get to help with some of his other nominations by shifting the discussion in a direction where anyone else seems like a sane, qualified candidate.
Wouldn't you think it was the equivalent of they're eating the cats or eating the dogs? You know, it just tossed out there as a distraction.
Okay, so let us, in our moments before we go to the top of the hour break, talk about Pam Bondi. Now, with Matt Gaetz out of the way, and Matt Gaetz saying, okay, Mr. President-elect, I will withdraw my nomination, then there was a flurry of stories as to, well, we're back to the drawing board. There's no idea. This could take weeks to figure out who is going to be the next nominee for the Attorney General. And before they could go to commercial, Pam Bondi was announced, who served on his legal team during his first impeachment. And if anything is we should say about this is that here is a human who actually has served in the role as Attorney General in the state of Florida. And so this now, Pam Bondi is the person that President-elect Trump has chosen to be Attorney General. She is a loyalist. She has that experience, especially in Florida. And he sees a Justice Department that is very politically hostile to him and feels that she is the person to turn that around. Jim Hendler.
You know, I was watching MSNBC last night and caught Alex Wagner, whose intro was, breaking news today, Trump takes a scandal-ridden Trump loyalist who has defended him in many ways out of the running for AG and instead appoints a Trump loyalist, scandal-ridden person. She said it better. But it was like if you could find somebody who was as close as possible to Gates in terms of loyalty, willingness to do things, owing Trump a favor. For those who don't know,
yes, but without the possibility of felonies.
Yeah. I mean, she was looking into Trump University. Suddenly the charges were dropped. Just by coincidence, Trump had just before that given a very large donation to a, I forget whether it was a foundation or whatever, that she ran.
Not for profit.
I mean, you know, it was like, in a normal democracy, that would have been such a scandal that it would have ended careers. And I mean, so would Trump having been, you know, convicted of rape. So would all these other things. I mean, it's just stunning what's going on now. And I would say I'm left speechless, but I've been talking about how I'm speechless. But the key thing is, I think Aaron did put it right, which is that I don't think Trump was putting Gates out there as a, you know, great, they'll shoot him down and I'll be able to put someone else in. I think he wanted Gates through. But Trump is amazingly good at turning on the dime. In fact, an hour before he told Gates that, you know, he didn't have the votes, he was interviewed on TV. And they said, you know, are you going to withdraw your nomination of Gates? And his answer was one word, no. Right? And, of course, he didn't. He let Gates resign. But, I mean, right. It's
I do also
theater
think
at its best.
I want to get the other reactions here. But I do think it's interesting, this Florida connection. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about Pam Bondi is that she is very close with Susie Wiles.
Right.
They have a lot of ties within the Florida political scene, which is sort of becoming the epicenter of much of the activity that's taking place.
Marco Rubio.
As far as the nominations go from Mar-a-Lago.
Trump has redefined politics from public service for the greater good to transactional for his own good. And the good of his, inner circle. So this isn't surprising. It's another loyalist who puts, the interest of Trump above the interest of the country. You know, she's anti-same-sex marriage. She's anti-recreational marijuana. She wants to overturn the Affordable Care Act. I mean, this is a reactionary person who is, just because she held an attorney general position in the state of Florida, is very dangerous. And, you know, she's proven her loyalty to Trump. And this is like watching an episode of The Sopranos and The Apprentice combined into one. And I feel bad I keep making TV references, but Trump is an entertainer. And this is clearly where he's taking his marching orders from, and that it's like, well, who's most loyal to Tony Soprano? They're the one that gets promoted to, you know, a captain or whatever. It's the same thing here. This is entirely transactional. And the fact that he announced her so quickly after Gates said he was withdrawing is remarkable, and also a sign that he clearly had somebody else in mind.
Students who are all economics majors from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge course. We just have a few moments before we wrap up, and I'm just curious, curious from all of the students, but I'd like to especially go to Arthur and John because, or begin with them at least, because you're both from Brazil, and I'm curious just a general of what the of the thoughts of the United States and its economy as you were growing up and how those thoughts have changed as you've come here and started to study.
So I think that pretty much anywhere in the world, the United States is highly influential, not just economically, but with Hollywood, music.
Right.
So pretty much everyone grows up, even if they don't speak English, they know the United States, they want to go in there. When I got here, I don't think I felt like it changed from like the perspective I had before. I think that when you get here, you start to realize, especially in the economics courses, how important the United States is to the world economy and how it affects everything. So,
'cause we think of that thing like the American dream. We're American dream.
Yeah,
like,
do you feel
that way, or is that just BS?
Yeah, I think I've met a lot of people who feel that way. They didn't speak any English. They were struggling to find a job in Brazil. And when you asked them what their dream was, they said they wanted to come to the U.S. and live here. So I do think that the United States is very influential.
Arthur?
Yeah, it's different for sure than what we see on the TV, what we hear from the news, this big, the paradise that the United States promotes itself for other countries outside.
More pharmaceutical commercials in real life. Yeah.
I think some stuff still gets us pretty disappointed, like the Pam Bondi indication. You're like, it's expected from Trump. She follows the same things, the same policies that Trump follows, but it's not really progressive as other countries such as Brazil has been in some areas moving forward, and you see America, this big influential country, sometimes moving backwards in terms of abortion, in terms of legalization or the Affordable Care Act, all this type of stuff. So it's conflicting.
Also, and is it because you're all very young, you're all 20, 21?
Yeah.
So that this has been, you know, we've been in a Trump era for 9 of those years. And I'm curious as to, even before that, if you come out and say that it's, you still look at it as, while we in this country on this show, we are constantly accused of pearl clutching and saying, oh my God, and the world's gone to hell, and that's not just Teresa, and but
we live in dangerous times.
That's right, we live in dangerous times, but you don't feel that way as much, I assume, when you're before you came here.
No, not at all.
Yeah,
I think there's a good, United States does a good job on promoting life here, and at the same time it doesn't want certain types of people to come, so that's interesting. We're talking about immigration and because we're not immigrants, we're white Brazilians that come here for school. We have non-immigration status, but we do know people that are trying to get here, and it makes it harder for them. So yeah, it's not the dream that was promoted before we came, for sure.
That's a fascinating perspective. Molly.
Yeah. When you talk about the American dream, I think it's interesting because it's something that, you know, as growing up as an American, you always hear about it and you learn about it. I think as I've become more educated, I still have hopes, but that dream has certainly faded away a little bit. When you
look into what our, not even just Trump, but most of our politicians are doing, it seems that big money interests are much more relevant to them than the people that they're supposed to be representing. Mm. And even like from a female perspective, like I was surprised that Gates withdrew, just because I looked at it from the perspective of President Trump has had a large history of sexual misconduct, and he's president. And I honestly didn't think that that would be where the line was drawn for most of the senators, and especially Republican senators. So when you're talking about an American dream, I don't think it's impossible, but I feel like it is fading away, especially for young people.
Hmm. That's, well, I certainly understand that. Yeah. Angela.
Yeah, so we're all young enough that this presidential election was the first one in time that I was able to vote in a presidential election. And it was, you know, it was very exciting. Molly and I were talking about how we felt very hopeful that day for the country. But I'm young enough. I can't remember a time where politics was not at the current state that it was. You know, the first time Trump ran, I was pretty young. And I remember everyone saying that this is insane, but then I grew up with it. So it's kind of shocking how I'm almost not shocked at some of the things that are coming out. It's now the norm for people to get away with things because they have money. And it might have always been that way, but it's becoming incredibly apparent now. And, you know, that whole idea of the future is female, it's hard to really believe that in the current state that we live in. So...
Were your hopes dashed? I mean, of being this is for both of you, but being young women, that you think that had the election results been different, that you would have felt different about being women and the future and what you were able to achieve?
I mean, absolutely. In finance and economics, those are both very male-dominated fields. That's where I spend all of my time in college, is, you know, the token female in my finance classes. So this idea that a woman would have been able to be president was this very exciting idea. And the fact that she lost to a convicted felon who mistreated women so horribly, it really did just sting a little bit harder.
Molly?
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything Angie said. When the news broke, it was definitely hit me harder. Just because I think the magnitude that Harris lost by was pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
She was highly qualified. I don't like to, like, romanticize any politician. But when you compare her to Trump, it seemed like the results should have not turned out the way that they did. And so I think a lot of women were disappointed and kind of fearful of the fact that maybe one of the reasons the margin was so large between her and Trump was due to the fact that she is a woman, and she is a woman of color.
Yeah.
And yet you keep going.
You have to, right? Yeah. I think if you stop caring and you stop trying, then, I mean, you lose everything, right? So all you can do is just, you know, keep trying to stay informed, stay educated, do what you can.
That was Molly McBain on the Roundtable panel on Friday, November 22nd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.